through 22, which is about 10 chapters, are largely taken up with the distribution of the land that had been conquered by the children of Israel under Joshua. This has some portions of it that is very, well, wordy. Just the kind of material I ought to teach, because I'm rather wordy myself. But I'm not going to get wordy about some of these passages, because in some cases we just have lists of names of cities and boundaries. I wonder, here we have, actually, yeah, we have on this map over here things that we're going to be discussing, the tribal allotments. So maybe we can make reference to them on the map. Chapter 13 begins by stating that even though the children of Israel had conquered the land and had taken the land, had come into possession of it, there were still cities and portions that were inhabited by Canaanites who had been resistant. And so there were more wars to be fought yet. Now these wars were to be fought by the whole nation, as had been the case previous to this, where the whole nation went together to fight the different Canaanite groups. But now there were just remaining pockets of Canaanite resistance in different cities. And the resistance had pretty much been broken for the most part by the major cities and capitals and kings already being defeated, so that the Jews were able, just as separate tribes, to go in or were expected at least to go in and take those areas that remained within their possession, within their inheritance, to drive out the Canaanites. It would appear the Jews never did this completely. All through this section we will find references to Canaanites who didn't leave, as in chapter 16, verse 10. "Then they drave not out the Canaanites that dwelt in Gezer, but the Canaanites dwell among the Ephraimites unto this day and serve under tribute." We have other instances of this in chapter 15, verse 63. It says, "As for the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the children of Judah could not drive them out. But the Jebusites dwell with the children of Judah at Jerusalem unto this day," which is proof that the book was written before David's time, because David later conquered the city of Jerusalem. We have also an instance in chapter 17, verses 12 and 13. Chapter 17, verses 12 and 13. It says, "Yet the children of Manasseh could not drive out the inhabitants of those cities, but the Canaanites would dwell in that land. Yet it came to pass, when the children of Israel were waxed strong, that they put the Canaanites to tribute, but did not utterly drive them out." So the best they did in some of these cases was to get the Canaanites to acknowledge the overlordship of the Israelites, so that the Canaanites actually paid tribute to them, just as at a later time Israel paid tribute to Persia, and after that to Greece and Rome. So the Canaanites who remained were put under tribute, but that was not really what was supposed to happen. They were supposed to be exterminated, but they weren't. And God had warned that if they did not wipe out all the Canaanites, that the religion of the Canaanites would live on among them and would snare them, would trap them, and would allure them into evil religions that would cause God to have to bring judgment upon them. So, chapter 13, verse 1, "Joshua was old and stricken in years, and the Lord said to him, 'You are now old and stricken in years, and there remains yet very much land to be possessed. This is the land that yet remains, all the borders of the Philistines and all the Geshuri, from Sihor, which is before Egypt, even unto the borders of Ekron, northward, which is counted to the Canaanite, five lords of the Philistines, the Gathites, the Ashdodites, the Eshcolites, or Eshcolanites, the Gittites, and the Ekronites, also the Avites. And from the south, all the land of the Canaanites and Meara, that is beside the Sidonians, unto Aphek, unto the borders of the Amorites, and the land of the Giblites, and all Lebanon toward the rising," that'd be toward the east, of course, "from Baal-Gad under Mount Hermon unto the entering of into Hamath, all the inhabitants of the hill country from Lebanon unto Misrephothmaim, And all the Sidonians, then will I drive out before the children of Israel. Only divide thou it by lot unto the Israelites for an inheritance as I have commanded thee. Now therefore divide this land for an inheritance unto the nine tribes and the half tribe of Manasseh. There are mentioned five lords of the Philistines that were not conquered, and as far as we know, they never really were completely driven out. The five Philistine cities remained with Israel for a long, long time. Even in the days of the later prophets, Isaiah and Jeremiah, they had prophecies that predicted still the doom of the Philistines. And so it shows that even in the late period of the monarchy of Judah, in the days of Hezekiah and later, there were still Philistines that had not yet come under judgment. The five cities of the Philistines you ought to memorize or know or recognize, they are mentioned in verse 3. Ekron is one of them, which is also mentioned again at the end of the chapter, the Ekronites. There's also the Gathites, which would be the inhabitants of Gaza, which is one of the cities. Ashdod is another of the cities. Eshkelon is another, and Gath, of which the Gittites, who are mentioned at the end of verse 3, the Gittites, they're the inhabitants of Gath. So the five cities of the Philistines, we're going to encounter them from time to time in the rest of biblical history. Ekron, Gaza, Ashdod, Eshkelon, and Gath. These are cities that never were conquered by the Jews. It's interesting that in this list it talks about all of Lebanon and Sidon, or the Sidonians, which really speaks of properties that are not within Palestine proper. They're not within the land of Canaan exactly. Sidons were Phoenicians. Tyre and Sidon were the two great cities of the Phoenicians. It shows how ancient this book is that the Sidonians are mentioned, but not the inhabitants of Tyre. At a later time, the Phoenicians would always be spoken of with reference to their chief city, Tyre. Tyre and Sidon were the two great cities, and Sidon apparently was the more considerable of the two cities at the time this book was written, which proves its antiquity, because by the time of Solomon, at least, Tyre had become much more considerable than Sidon. Here we have no reference to Tyre, only to the Sidonians, which would be the Phoenicians to the north, Lebanon to the east and north. So we can see that there's a lot of land outside of Canaan, outside of Palestine proper, that was to be taken as well. Now, in verses 8 through the end of the chapter, we have a reminder that the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half of the tribe of Manasseh were told that they could stay on the east side of the Jordan. Before the conquest even began, they got permission from Moses to live on the east side of Jordan. And here we can see on the map, this is the Jordan River here, this dark black line, which from the back may not be very visible. But these three, the pink up here to the north, the green here, and the purple down at the bottom, represent the portions that were given to Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben. It's interesting that Manasseh got so much territory. Reuben was the firstborn of Jacob, and he only gets this little portion down here, down by on the east side of the Dead Sea, or the Salt Sea as it was called in those days. Gad gets a somewhat larger portion, but Manasseh, the tribe of Manasseh, which was really a half-tribe, because, of course, Joseph was divided into two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. Manasseh must have been very large, because they not only received a large portion over on the east side of Jordan up here to north, but also Manassites received a portion over on the in Canaan, stretched all the way from the Mediterranean Sea over to the Jordan. So it was one of the few tribes that had coastal lands in the Mediterranean and also riverfront property. In fact, the only other tribe that had both those things in space to west the whole breadth of the land was Judah. And Judah only had a little bit of riverfront there. So Manasseh really was a considerable half-tribe of the house of Joseph. So in Joshua 13 and verse 7, it says that the land within Canaan had to be divided among 9.5 tribes. The half would be the half of the Manassites, because half of them were on the east side. And then the other 9 tribes had to receive their portion. So we see the borders of the land of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh, half of Manasseh, on the other side of Jordan in the rest of chapter 13. We don't really need to read all those cities' names. A lot of them we can't identify today, but they are shown there on the map. The last verse in the chapter says, "But unto the tribe of Levi, Moses gave not any inheritance. The Lord God of Israel was their inheritance, as he said unto them." Now, this is something I'll comment about later, because it comes up again and again in this passage, that the Levites did not get any land, any tribal portion, because the Lord is their inheritance. We'll see more about that in even just a few verses from this point. When we get into chapter 14, it says, "And these are the countries which the children of Israel inherited in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of the fathers of the tribes of the children of Israel distributed for inheritance to them. By lot was their inheritance, as the Lord commanded by the hand of Moses for the 9.5 tribes. For Moses had given the inheritance of 2.5 tribes on the other side of Jordan, but unto the Levites he gave no inheritance among them. For the children of Joseph were 2 tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim. Therefore they gave no part unto the Levites in the land, save cities to dwell in, and with their suburbs, for their cattle and for their substance." Now, it's interesting, there's more than one reason that is given for the Levites not having land. In chapter 13, verse 33, the reason is because the Lord is their inheritance. They don't receive an inheritance of real estate. Although we do know they got certain cities designated for them to live in, and those are listed in a later chapter. And it mentions those cities without naming them in chapter 14 and verse 4. Another reason is given for Levi not getting an inheritance, and it really can't be the real reason, but it's an interesting thing that it's brought up. In verse 4 there, it says that the tribe of Joseph was divided into 2, which means that would make technically 13 tribes, since if Joseph were only 1 tribe, there would be 12 tribes, but when Joseph's kin become 2, then you've got 13 tribes to divide between. And yet the writer is assuming that the land should only be divided into 12 pieces, and therefore Levi wouldn't get one. Someone had to not get a portion, because there were still 12 others that needed them. But when you look at it, you can see that the land was divided into more than 12 pieces, because, as I said already, Manasseh got 2 portions, one on each side of the river. Okay, well, verse 5, "As the Lord commanded Moses, so the children of Israel did as they did, and they divided the land." Now, we're told that it was the priest and Joshua who divided the land, and it was done by casting lots. It says that in verse 2, "By lot was their inheritance." this way no one could suggest that there was partiality being shown by Joshua or the priest, but that it was left in the hands of God to decide who got what. And how exactly they worked it out, we don't know. They must have had some kind of a plot of the land drawn up. And somehow, maybe they just named individual cities, and the tribes would draw lots for them. And so whatever cities were drawn by the members, by the elders of one tribe, or by the priests on behalf of one tribe, belonged to those people and ended up delineating their inheritance. We don't know exactly how the procedure went, but it was through the drawing of lots so that it might be from God and not from man. And it took the matter totally out of the hands of man as to who would get which portions. That way there wouldn't be any cause for jealousy, where you can see, as I pointed out, that Manasseh received an awful lot more land than anyone else, if you include the land on the east side of Jordan. Of course, a lot of this was probably not very usable land. Judah, within the land, got the largest portion. Simeon later got a little bit of Judah's land, because Judah didn't need that much. But all this pink here that's Judah's, and the green under it, was originally Judah, and then the green down there represents what was given to Simeon later out of Judah's territory. But when one tribe gets more than another, you see why some people might think that favoritism had been shown, and that's why they had to use the drawing of lots so everyone would know whatever land you got is what God gave you. we might question whether drawing lots really a valid way of knowing God's will, but I would remind you that the book of Proverbs suggests that drawing lots at least was considered a true means of discerning the will of God. It says in Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 33, Proverbs 16, 33, the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing of it is of the Lord. In other words, people can draw lots or cast lots if they wish, but the way it turns out is going to be what God decides. The whole disposing of it is of the Lord. So, it suggests that casting lots is that God sometimes reveals His will through. We know the apostles who were awaiting the day of Pentecost in the upper room cast lots to choose an apostle to replace Judas. They apparently thought that was still a valid means. I'm just hearing the will of God. Yes, Tim.
It seems that the amount of men per tribe and the numbers. It seems that the higher count, a higher population one has the bigger areas.
Uh-huh. Well, that would make sense. God would probably do that.
I mean, there's no ratio there. It just seems the bigger ones are larger.
It's not that many. Yeah, it is interesting. Of course, the quality of the land would have to be taken into consideration, too. Like all that property of Manasseh on the east side of Jordan, probably a lot of that was just desert. It was grazing land, and that's what they wanted it for. Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh asked for that land because they had a lot of flocks, and they wanted grazing land. And they might have needed that much grazing land just because it was sparsely, some of it was sparsely grown.
That's a pretty nice land to go on hikes
and, It's awfully hard to know what things were like back then. Like the whole Dead Sea area was lush like the Garden of God in the days of Abraham. And now the area around the Dead Sea isn't that way at all. And the land's been denuded. And it's hard to tell. It's hard to really tell exactly how things were back then. But the description of some parts of the land in the Bible don't fit the descriptions of the same parts today in many cases. So really what the quality of the portions was at the time. But we know that God is the one who sovereignly chose for the people their inheritance. Just as it says in Psalm 47. Psalm 47, which we read the other day. It says in verse 4, He shall choose our inheritance for us. Of course, that is looking forward to a spiritual inheritance there. But the idea is that God is the one who chooses our inheritance, and He chose the inheritance, the portions for the people of the different tribes. That could be applied to our Christian life, too, in that each of us has our own set of assets, spiritual assets that God has given us. Everyone has different gifts, different opportunities. Some might tend to envy those of another or look down on those of another, but there's really no place for doing that, as we saw in 1 Corinthians, because it's the Lord who chooses who's going to have which gift and who's going to have which opportunity. And the Lord raises up one and puts down another. And so spiritually, our inheritance is also chosen for us by God, that we can't really complain to anyone except Him if we feel like we got a raw deal. And, of course, we can't really complain to Him either, because we haven't gotten a raw deal from Him. We've gotten better than we deserve. Down in verse 6, then, we get an update on what happened to Caleb. You remember that Caleb and Joshua were both the good spies. The spies brought back the good report way back in Numbers chapter 14 when Moses sent the spies to spy out the land. Well, Joshua has become very prominent since that time as the new leader. But what happened to Caleb? Well, here we have an update on him through the rest of this chapter from verse 6. Then the children of Judah came to Joshua in Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said unto him, Thou knowest the thing that the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, concerning me and thee in Kadesh Barnea. 40 years old I was then when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to espy out the land. And I brought him word again that was in mine heart, as it was in mine heart. Nevertheless, my brethren that went up with me made the heart of the people to melt, but I wholly followed the Lord my God. And Moses sware on that day, saying, Surely the land whereon thy feet have trodden shall be thine inheritance and thy children's forever, because thou hast wholly followed the Lord my God. And now behold, the Lord hath kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years, even since the Lord spake his word unto Moses, while the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness, and now, lo, I am this day 85 years old. As yet I am as strong this day as I was in the day when Moses sent me. Imagine being as virile at age 85 as you were when you were 40. As strength was then, even so is my strength now, for war, both to go out and to come in. Now therefore, give me this mountain, whereof the Lord spake in that day. For thou heardest in that day how the Anakims were there, that the cities were great and fenced. If so be, the Lord will be with me, then I shall be able to drive them out, as the Lord said. And Joshua blessed him, and gave unto Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, Hebron, for an inheritance. Hebron, therefore, became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, to this day, because that he wholly followed the Lord of God of Israel. And the name of Hebron before was Kirjath Arba, which Arba was a great man among the Anakims, and the land had rest from war. Now this city Hebron that was given to Caleb, I'm not really sure how things worked out politically there. It was also later made a city of refuge, and it was also a Levitical city, as I recall. We'll find when the cities of the Levites are given. I believe that Hebron is one of those cities. Yes, in chapter 21, 11, the Kohathites, one of the groups of the Levites, among the cities that were given to them was the city of Hebron, according to chapter 21, 11. So, in some sense, the city was given to Caleb, who was of the tribe of Judah, and yet it was also a city of refuge and a Levitical city. So I don't really know how all that worked out. but it did somehow. At any rate, one thing to notice is the time element here. In verse 10, chapter 14, verse 10, he says, these 45 years. The 45 years apparently refer to the period of time from the time that he spied out the land until the time he's making the statement. Which means we know that 40 or 38 years elapsed from the time they spied out the land until the time they entered Canaan, because they wandered in the wilderness that long. 38 or 39 years elapsed there. And now apparently 5 additional years had happened during which the conquest was taking place. It's been about 6 years. I mean, if he was 40 when the command was given, we're talking 5 or 6 years the conquest has taken up to this point. So that gives us some kind of a time element to figure how long this is taking. Notice how many times it says of Caleb that he wholly followed the Lord. He said so about himself in verse 8. Moses said so about him in verse 9. It's quoting what Moses had said. And then the writer of Joshua says the same thing about him in verse 14. Because he wholly followed the Lord God of Israel. I think this is repeated so frequently so that we'll pay attention to it. Because it shows the man who came into his inheritance. I mean, he and Joshua were unique of their generation. They were the only two that really entered into the inheritance. Joshua, we have many things said of him, of course, because he became very famous. But Caleb, the main thing we hear about him, the main characteristic that set him apart from the rest of his generation, was that he wholly followed the Lord his God. If you look at Numbers chapter 14, which is the story of that provocation, Numbers chapter 14, when God told the Israelites they would have to wander until they were all dead in the wilderness, he makes exception for Caleb in Numbers 14:24. But my servant Caleb, because he had another spirit with him. And of course, that means that he was motivated by a different spiritual dynamic than everyone else. And has followed me fully. Him will I bring into the land wherein he went, and his seed shall possess it. So, he was allowed to come in because he had a different spirit than the rest and because he followed the Lord wholly. The fact that he followed the Lord wholly was demonstrated that he had a different spirit than the rest. They didn't. If you look at chapter 32 of Numbers. Numbers chapter 32, verses 11 and 12. It says, surely none of the men that came up out of Egypt from 20 years old and upward shall see the land which I swear unto Abraham, unto Isaac, unto Jacob, because they have not wholly followed me, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, and Joshua the son of Nun, for they have wholly followed the Lord. So it says Caleb and Joshua both that they wholly followed the Lord, and of those that would not enter the Canaan, it was those who have not wholly followed the Lord, in verse 11. That's Numbers 32, verses 11 and 12. So the whole issue of entering into the inheritance was whether one wholly followed the Lord or partially. Now, those who didn't enter into Canaan followed the Lord too. I mean, they did follow the Lord out of Egypt, into the wilderness, and they followed the cloud around in the desert. And it's not as though they didn't follow the Lord at all, but there were limits to how far they would follow the Lord. When it became apparent to them that they were facing great risks to their lives and to their children's lives by the thought of going in and taking the giant's land from them, they weren't willing to follow the Lord that far. Only Joshua and Caleb wholly followed the Lord. That is, there were no limits to how far they would follow God. They would risk life and limb. They would risk their families. They would risk all and put their lives in God's hands, and they would just wholly follow Him. Everyone else did not. And because of this seeming recklessness of trust in God and the willingness to follow God into any situation, Joshua and Caleb were rewarded and were able to come into the land, as we see. And so Caleb was given a portion of Hebron. Now in chapter 15, we see something else about Caleb's family. I'm not going to say very much about most of chapter 15, because what we have there is the allotment given to the tribe of Judah. And you can just see with your eyes on the map where Judah was given, all the names of the cities and the borders that are given there in this lengthy passage are not necessary for us to go over. It's interesting, it says that in verse 8, though, the border went up by the valley of the son of Hinnom unto the south side of the Jebusite. The same is Jerusalem. And the border went up to the top of the mountain that lieth before the valley of Hinnom westward, which is at the end of the valley of the giants northward. Now, the valley of Hinnom was, of course, that valley where the Jews later apostatized and worshipped Molech and Baal and burned their children alive unto Molech. And after the Babylonian captivity, the returning exiles wished to show their contempt for that idolatry that had been practiced there. And so they made that valley the place where they would deposit all the garbage of the city. It became the garbage dump. And they apparently, to keep sickness or whatever from spreading, they kept perpetual fires burning there. That is at least what is traditionally said to have been taking place there, so that there were continual fires in the valley of Hinnom. And the expression Gehenna, which is the term Jesus most frequently used about 11 times in his teaching to refer to hell or to the lake of fire, is just a Greek way of saying Hinnom, the valley of Hinnom. Hinnom was the name of some ancient hero who's unknown to us from history, but Hinnom was a proper name. It was called the Valley of the Son of Hinnom, and later known as Gehenna in the New Testament, which became an emblem of the eternal fires of hell. That valley was right outside of Jerusalem, to the north, and it was a valley between two hills. There was Mount Zion on the south of the valley, which is where Jerusalem was built, and on the other side of the valley, the north side, was what they call here the Valley of the Giants. Also, it came to be known as the Valley of Evil, the Mountain of Evil Counsel. I don't know why it was called that. I don't know enough about it to know, but there's these two mountains in the Valley of Hinnom between. Now, it says here that the south border of Jerusalem, or the south side of the Jebusites, was given to Judah. Later on, we will see that when the tribe of Benjamin receives their portion, that they also receive Jerusalem. In chapter 18 and verse 28, the last verse in chapter 18, this is in this chapter from verses 11 through 28, it's giving the inheritance of Benjamin. And it says in verse 28, and Zelah and Eleph and Jebusai, which is Jerusalem. Jebusai, because Jebusites lived there. So, Jerusalem was given also to the Benjamites. It says at the end, this is the inheritance of the children of Benjamin according to their families. What this means, of course, is that Jerusalem must have lay on the border of Judean and Benjamite territory, And the northern part of the city, Benjamite, and the southern portion was of Judah. And that was the case later on in the days of David also. So the Benjamites shared Jerusalem with Judah. And it's interesting that later in the days of Rehoboam, when the kingdom split into the north and south, 10 of the tribes defected, but Benjamin remained loyal to Judah in the south. And so it was Benjamin and Judah that remained the southern kingdom, and they shared Jerusalem. And of course, that's where the Davidic kings were reigning in Jerusalem, and they had the temple there. So it's not surprising that the Benjamites would be attached to Jerusalem. It was partly their city. And that the government and the religion that was centered there, they remained true to that when all the other tribes broke up. Okay, further about the territory of Judah in chapter 15. In verse 6, it says there, the border went up to Beth-Hogla and passed along by the north of Beth-Araba, or Beth-Araba. Beth-Araba was apparently a desert area, or wilderness area, according to chapter 15 and verse 61. It says, in the wilderness of Beth-Araba. There's a wilderness area called Beth-Araba, and it's said to be on the border of Judah, but it was also Benjamin, apparently, according to chapter 18. Again, we're reading the Benjamite territory. Joshua 18, verse 22 says, Beth-Araba, and Zemaraim, and Bethel. So, Beth-Araba was a wilderness area that also bordered between the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. There were a number of places that were shared by Judah and Benjamin. Now, the main thing of interest in chapter 15, besides giving all these different cities that became the portion of Judah, and that's what chapter 15 is all about, is the tribe of Judah. We have, in verses 16 through 19, a brief story about Caleb's daughter and her marriage to Othniel. And these four verses have their are repeated practically verbatim in the first chapter of Judges. Judges 1, verses 12 through 15. And the reason they're introduced there is because Othniel, who became the son-in-law of Caleb, also became the first of the judges in the book of Judges. He's the first deliverer of the children of Israel in the generation after Joshua's time. So he is introduced to us here. He's of the tribe of Judah. And since we're reading about the inheritance of the tribe of Judah, they give this little story in verse 16 through 19. Caleb said, he that smiteth Kirjathsepher and taketh it, to him will I give Aksah, my daughter, to wife. A similar offer was made by Saul in 1 Samuel 17:25. 1 Samuel 17:25, King Saul said, anyone who kills Goliath can marry his daughter. And so we find Caleb, that must have been a way of making sure you got courageous sons-in-law or mighty ones. And so Caleb said, anyone who can smite this city can have my daughter Aksah for wife. And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb. Now that is to say, Kenaz was the brother of Caleb. Therefore, Othniel was Caleb's nephew, took it, and he gave him Aksah, his daughter, to wife. So Othniel was both Caleb's nephew and son-in-law. He married his first cousin, in other words. And it came to pass, as she came unto him, that she moved him to ask of her father a field, and off her ass, and Caleb said unto her, what wouldest thou? Now the daughter comes to her father Caleb, and he says, what do you want? And she answered, give me a blessing, for thou hast given me a south land, give me also springs of water. And he gave her the upper springs and the nether springs. So apparently the land that he originally gave them with Kirjathsepher didn't have much water. It was probably the part of the desert region of the Negev. And so she needed some springs of water. So he gave her some other territory in addition that had running water. So this is what happened a little further down the line in Caleb's family. His nephew married his daughter, and we know from the book of Judges he later became the first of the judges and a great deliverer of the children of Israel. The rest of the chapter is taken up with naming cities that the children of Judah inherited. We won't go into them all. We only mention that in verse 63 it says, as for the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the children of Judah could not drive them out, but Jebusites dwell with the children of Judah. at Jerusalem unto this day. That circumstance changed in 2 Samuel 5. We won't turn there right now, but in 2 Samuel 5, verses 5 through 6, we read of how David entered Jerusalem and it became known as the City of David. But until his time, which was about 300 years after this, or 200 or 300 years after this, it remained under Jebusite control. Chapter 16, then, we move along to talk about the children of Joseph. And by children of Joseph here, we don't really mean, well, we do. We got Manasseh and Ephraim considered in chapters 16 and 17. Remember, the children of Joseph were in two tribes now, the tribe of Ephraim and the tribe of Manasseh. And in verses 5 through the end of the chapter, through 10, we have the inheritance of Ephraim, and then in chapter 17, the inheritance of Manasseh. That would be the inheritance of Manasseh within the land. We already discussed the inhabitants of the inheritance of Manasseh on the east side of Jordan when we were talking about chapter 13. But in chapter 17, we have the interior inheritance. So here, this yellow area on this map represents Ephraim's area. It's interesting that it's as small as it is, because Ephraim really was the most significant tribe of the northern kingdom. When the kingdom split, Judah was obviously the significant kingdom in the south, because it was just Judah and Benjamin. But of the whole northern confederacy, which became the kingdom of Israel, Ephraim was by far the most significant tribe. It's so much so that the whole northern kingdom was sometimes simply called Ephraim. Just like the southern kingdom was just called Judah, even though there were two tribes there. Benjamin was there, but Benjamin was so insignificant by comparison, they just called the kingdom Judah. The northern kingdom was called alternately Israel or Ephraim. And Ephraim yet got a very small portion. And the cities of Ephraim are given in chapter 16, 5 through 10. Verse 10 reminds us that they also failed to drive all the Canaanites out of their territory, out of Gezer. And so both the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Ephraim received portions that they were unable to drive the Canaanites out of at least one city each. Then we have the tribe of Manasseh considered in chapter 17. We don't need to read all of this, of course. In verses 3 through 6, we have the daughters of Zelophehad coming to Joshua. You might remember they came to Eleazar and Joshua. These were the daughters that were mentioned back in Numbers chapter 27, verses 1 through 11. They were of the tribe of Manasseh, and their father had died, leaving no sons. And there were four of these daughters. And they were concerned that since their father had no son, and they, the daughters, would marry usually someone else, and therefore be of a different family, that their father would have no family inheritance left to his name. And so it was determined that if they would marry within their own tribe, then the portion that they received they would receive a portion along with the men. Now, this decision was made by God and communicated by Moses, and now they come to Joshua and Eleazar to remind them that Moses had decreed that they should receive a portion. And it gives us a foreglimpse into the fact that God was going to make no difference between men and women in the inheritance. We know from Galatians chapter 3, Paul says there's no more Jew or Gentile or male or female or bond or free. In Christ, we're all one. And that suggests, of course, that with respect to our redemption and our inheritance before God, there is no superiority or inferiority based upon these categories. And that women, which isn't too surprising to us maybe in our society, but in that society it was quite a radical thing, that women had equal standing with men. This statement, if you want it in your notes, is Galatians 3:28. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither bond nor free, there is neither male nor female, for ye are all one in Christ Jesus. Galatians 3:28. And so we find that these daughters are given as an example of God ruled that daughters could carry on the father's name inheritance if there were no sons to do so, and that they were to receive equal inheritance as if they had been sons. We can read the verses 3 through 6, but Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Maker, the son of Manasseh, had no sons, but daughters. And these are the names of the daughters. Mala and Noah and Hagla and Milcah and Tirzah. There were actually five. I was under the impression there were four. And they came near before Eleazar the priest and before Joshua the son of Nun and before the princes, saying, "The Lord commanded Moses to give us an inheritance among our brethren. Therefore, according to the commandment of the Lord, he gave them an inheritance among the brethren of their father." Now, that again, the command that they're referring to is back in Numbers 27, and the story is in verses 1 through 11 of that chapter. "And there fell 10 portions to Manasseh besides the land of Gilead and Bashan, which were on the other side of Jordan, because the daughters of Manasseh had an inheritance among his sons. And the rest of Manasseh's sons had the land of Gilead." Gilead is a region on the east of Jordan. Okay, I might just add that verse 11 tells us Manasseh had in Issachar and Asher, Beth Shean and her towns. Now, not only did Manasseh have huge properties themselves, but they also had a few cities within the areas of Asher and Issachar. You might say, well, why is this? It's no doubt because they picked the cities when the lots were drawn, and God gave them those cities as well as that they were given. Within Issachar and Asher, they also got some inheritance. And the cities that they had in those territories are given in verse 11. Then verse 12 says, "Yet the children of Manasseh could not drive out the inhabitants of those cities, but the Canaanites would dwell in that land, so they too failed to fully take the land." Verse 14 says, "And the children of Joshua spoke to children of Joseph spoke to Joshua, saying, 'Why hast thou given me but one lot and one portion to inherit, seeing I am a great people, forasmuch as the Lord hath blessed me hitherto?'" Now, it sounds to me like they... I'm not sure exactly why they said this when they were the tribe of Manasseh and they'd been given already two portions, and they say, "Why have you given us only one?" This, perhaps, would be something going back and telling something they had said before he decided to give them land within the land, since he had only given them land on the other side. And they might have said, "Well, there's many of us, and we need some land inside too." Though I'm not sure why they said, "You've only given us one portion." But they apparently were a great people. I mean, that is a numerous people, because they had a lot of territory, and they were already saying, "There's not enough room for us. There's a lot of us." And so verse 15 says, "Joshua answered them, 'If you be a great people, then get thee up to the wood country and cut down for thyself there the land of the Perizzites and of the giants, if Mount Ephraim be too narrow for thee.'" Well, maybe we're here considering the Ephraimites. I'm sorry. Because we were talking about the Manassites until this time, I was under the impression we were talking about the tribe of Manasseh here, but perhaps it's the tribe of Ephraim that's complaining here. The children of Joseph in verse 14 would then be probably Ephraim. And that would make sense, because Ephraim was a great people, and they did only have a small portion given to them. And maybe because the tribe of Manasseh had two portions given, the tribe of Ephraim said, "Why'd you give us only one?" And we're big people too. So Joshua said, "Well, if the mount of Ephraim is too narrow for you, too small for you, then go up to the woods and cut down trees, clear the land, and take the land from the Perizzites and the giants." And the children of Joseph said, "The hill is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites that dwell in the land of the valley have chariots of iron, both they who are of Beth Shean and her town, wood, and thou shalt cut it down, and the outgoings of it shall be thine, for thou shalt drive out the Canaanites, though they have iron chariots, and though they be strong." So he said, if you're so great, then show your greatness by going up and conquering these Canaanites in the mountain country, the wooded country, and clears out, you can have the territory for yourselves. And so we don't hear whether they succeeded in doing that or not, but he assures them that he believes they can do it, despite the fact that the enemies have iron chariots and are strong. He, of course, knows the Lord will be with them if they wholly follow him. Now, chapter 18 then gives us a second division of the land. Up till now, the children of Judah and of Joseph, the Ephraimites and the Manassites, have received portions. And apparently some time passed. Now, in the meantime, apparently the other tribes were just kind of living wherever they could live, but didn't have official tribal portions given to them yet. Why this was delayed, we're not told. But Joshua seemed to think it was their fault, that they were supposed to take the initiative and come and come before the priest and ask to do this, and they didn't bother. They just settled wherever they were. At any rate, the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled together at Shiloh now and set up the tabernacle of the congregation there, and the land was subdued before them. And there remained among the children of Israel seven tribes which had not yet received their inheritance. And Joshua said to the children of Israel, "How long are you slack to go and possess the land which the Lord God of your fathers hath given you? Give out from among you three men for each tribe, and I will send them, and they shall rise and go through the land and describe it according to the inheritance of them. And they shall come again to me. And they shall divide it into seven parts. Judah shall abide in their coast on the south, and the house of Joseph shall abide in their coast. Ye shall therefore describe the land into seven parts and bring the description hither to me, that I may cast lots for you here before the Lord our God. But Levites have no part among you, for the priesthood of the Lord is their inheritance. And Gad and Reuben, the half-tribe of Manasseh, have received their inheritance beyond the Jordan on the east, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave them." So, the tabernacle was set up in Shiloh. This was where it remained until 1 Samuel. Apparently, through the entire book of Judges, the tabernacle remained at this place in Shiloh. But in 1 Samuel, chapter 4, there was a war. And the Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant at Shiloh. In 1 Samuel 4:22, actually verse 11. 1 Samuel 4:11 says, "The Ark of God was taken." Apparently, when the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they also destroyed Shiloh, the city, and the tabernacle. The Ark, when it was recaptured, when it was brought back from the Philistines, didn't go back to Shiloh. It went to went somewhere else, to man's house. And the tabernacle, I guess, wasn't fully destroyed, though Shiloh itself as a place was. And the tabernacle seems to have been transferred to a place called Nob at that time. In 1 Samuel 21, there's a mention of David fleeing from Saul and stopping by the tabernacle to get showbread to eat. And that was at a place called Nob. But Shiloh is where they set it up in Joshua's day, and it remained there for a few hundred years during the Judges period, and then in Samuel's day, the Philistines destroyed Shiloh, and the Ark and the tabernacle were moved elsewhere. In Jeremiah chapter 7, there's a reference back to what had happened to Shiloh. Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 12. The prophet says, verse 11. "Is this house which is called by my name become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, even I have seen it, saith the Lord. But go ye now unto my place which was at Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it for the wickedness of my people Israel." Now, what he's saying is, in Jeremiah's day, there were people saying that Jerusalem would not fall to the Babylonians because Jerusalem was the sacred city, and the temple was there. And God would never allow the sacred city where the temple was to fall to the pagans. He says, "Oh yeah? Go check out Shiloh. They had the tabernacle there, didn't they? And look what I did to them because of their wickedness." In other words, he's saying, as I destroyed Shiloh, or as I allowed the heathen to destroy Shiloh, I'm going to allow them to destroy Jerusalem also. And don't find any false comfort in the fact there's a shrine to God here. That's not going to keep you safe if you're wicked. So that is that's the history of Shiloh. They set up the tabernacle there in chapter 18 of Joshua, verse 1. And it remained there until 1 Samuel chapter 4. Joshua sent each of the seven tribes sent three men out as survey parties to see what land was not yet apportioned. And they brought back descriptions of it, and then Joshua would cast lots for it. And so we have in the following two chapters a description of which portions fell to each of the tribes. Chapter 18, verse 11, through the end of the chapter, 28, is what the tribe of Benjamin received. And what they did receive was a small strip of territory which was between the portions of Ephraim and Judah. And you can see it on the map there. Then chapter 19, verses 1 through 9 describe the portion given to Simeon. Reuben, of course, we've already seen, who was the oldest of Jacob's children, received land on the opposite side of Jordan. Simeon was the next oldest. He didn't receive much, as a matter of fact. In fact, his inheritance was within the portion of Judah, within the portion that had already been given to Judah. In verse 1 of 19, it says, "And the second lot came forth to Simeon, even for the tribe of the children of Simeon, according to their families, and their inheritance was within the inheritance of the children of Judah." You might remember that when Jacob was blessing his sons on his deathbed, he excluded Reuben from the birthright because of his having gone into his father's concubine. Simeon and Levi were next in line, but they had conspired together to destroy the inhabitants of Shechem through a ruse when they had all the men circumcise themselves and then they killed them all while they were disabled. And so Jacob had pronounced a curse upon both Simeon and Levi and said basically, they will be scattered among their brethren. In other words, they won't really prosper and they'll just be scattered. Well, Simeon's portion was, you know, they were just kind of scattered in the, within the tribal portions of Judah. And Levi, of course, was scattered in another sense because they became the priestly group and they were scattered and had cities spread out in the different inheritances too. Nothing more needs to be said about the tribe of Simeon's inheritance here. Then verses 10 through 16 gives us the inheritance of Zebulun. There is reference there to a Bethlehem in verse 15, but that should not be mistaken for the Bethlehem where Jesus was born. Bethlehem where Jesus was born was in the precincts of Judah, Bethlehem Judah as it was called. And it was probably called Bethlehem Judah because there was also a Bethlehem Zebulun. We find later on near the end of the book of Judges a story about a man who came from Bethlehem, Judah. Also, I believe Ruth and her family, but Naomi and her family came from Bethlehem, Judah. The reason it's called Bethlehem, Judah is because there was another Bethlehem in the tribal region of Zebulun, which they didn't want to confuse the two. But in chapter 19, verse 15, there's a reference to Bethlehem, which was in the precincts of Zebulun. Then in verses 17 through 23, the inheritance of Issachar, 24 through 31, gives us the inheritance of Asher. And 32 through 39, the inheritance of Naphtali. And then verse 40 through 48, the inheritance of Dan. Now all of these, except for Simeon, received portions up in the northern part, in the region which was later Samaria and Galilee in the days of Jesus. You remember the whole land was divided into three parts in Jesus' day. The southern part was Judea, which corresponded largely with the old time Judah, tribe of Judah. But then the middle portion, which was Manasseh, Ephraim, and Dan, became what in Jesus' time was called Samaria. And then Issachar, Zebulun, Naphtali, and Asher were in the territories that became Galilee. Now, in Isaiah, there's a prediction made that a light would shine in the regions of Zebulun and Naphtali, which is up there in the Galilean area by the Sea of Galilee. Zebulun and Naphtali are right there in the middle of Galilee. And in Isaiah chapter 9, in verse 1, at the end of verse 1, the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterward he shall grievously afflict her by the way of the beyond Jordan in Galilee of the nations. Verse 2, the people that walked in darkness have seen a great light, and they that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined. This verse is quoted by Matthew in Matthew 4, verses 15 and 16, as a being fulfilled when Jesus began his Galilean ministry. His public ministry began in Galilee. And so Matthew saw that as a fulfillment of this prophecy, that in the regions of Zebulun and Naphtali, the light began to shine. There by the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus preached, the region of Naphtali, and then Zebulun was right next to it. So these portions were given to them in Joshua's day and later became Galilee. Yeah.
I went back and checked the numbers as far as the breakdown. There really isn't any rhyme or reason.
Manasseh was the smallest. It's interesting. Yeah. Well, you know, that's interesting because that's sort of the way God does things too. When He hands out blessings, He kind of shows His sovereignty and doesn't do things the way that you'd demand or the way you'd expect necessarily. He just does it the way He wants to do it, and just says, if you don't like it, that's the way I do it. You know, and you know, a lot of times you say, well, why did He do it that way? Why did He give that person that opportunity, or why did He raise that person up or put that person down or give those gifts to that person? And a lot of times it doesn't seem like He did the right thing. I'll tell you, there's been times when I saw people who had very virtuous, when I was single and I was looking for a wife. I remember I saw a lot of very virtuous women who were married to slobs, you know, and I thought, well, why did God give that wonderful wife to that creep, you know? When there's a wonderful guy like me out here looking for a wonderful wife, you know? And I never got answers to those questions. God gives gifts the way He wants to and doesn't necessarily give an answer to us for why He did it. It's the way He deals in each person's life. It's His business, I guess. And that's what He guards. Does it? Let me see if my Bible has a map in the back of this stuff. Really? I see. Well, you know what it probably is? I'm just taking a guess at it. It's probable that some of the cities that make up the boundaries have not been really located yet. I mean, there's long lists of cities. Probably a lot of them have not really been excavated yet, and no one knows for sure where they are. So the map makers have had to use a little bit of their imagination, I would imagine. And so that's probably why there's some differences. Probably in general, they're in the same areas, right? But there's just some differences to the exact borders. Yeah. That's probably due to the fact that some of the cities that make up the boundaries are no one's really quite sure where they were. But the map makers have had to make an educated guess. And some of them... development. At this time, it's about 1350 BC. Well, that's in the same time period. Yeah. Okay. A lot of these cities that have been excavated, according to what I was reading to you from Haley's handbook, he said that a lot of the excavations that they've dug up date from about 1400 BC. So that's around the period of the conquest. All right, now chapter 20 then, we have to talk about the cities of refuge. It doesn't take very long, it's only 9 verses. And we don't even have to read it. In going through the Pentateuch, you've encountered the cities of refuge on many occasions. I mean, they have... It seems like Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, and I don't know whether Numbers does or not, but I know those three books all have chapters that deal with the city of refuge. You're well familiar with what they were for. They were the place where someone who had accidentally killed somebody could flee to avoid vengeance from the relatives of the deceased. Because in their society, it was considered that if a man murdered another, that he was answerable to his brother or to his next of kin. That actually goes all the way back to what God decreed after the flood in Genesis chapter 9, where God first laid out the principle of capital punishment in Genesis chapter 9. He said it this way in verse 5, Surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require it. At the hand of every man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of a man. That means I will require it at the hand of every man's brother. Is that the deceased, the victim, if he had a brother, his brother would be the avenger of blood and would put to death the murderer. So there would be, in most cases, if someone was killed, an avenger of blood, a relative who would take up the cause of the deceased and go to kill the murderer. Now, if a man accidentally killed another man, in many cases, he'd be the only one who knew whether it was really an accident or not. As far as the brother of the deceased is concerned, he might tend to be angry and not very charitable, and he might just assume the worst and figure, well, you killed him, you've shed blood, and I'm going to kill you. And he could do so legally. The avenger of blood could actually do that, even if you'd accidentally killed someone. But if you had been really innocent and there had been no malice aforetime, the Bible says, then you could flee to one of these cities. There were three on each side of the Jordan, taken from six different tribal portions. And their names are given in verse 7. Kadesh was one of them. Shechem was another. Kirjath Arba, which is Hebron, is another. Then down in verse 8, we have Bezer on the other side of Jordan. Bezer, Ramoth Gilead, and Golan. So these six cities became the city's refuge, and if you had accidentally killed someone, you could go there and you'd get a fair trial. If the elders or the priests in that city believed your story that you were really innocent and that you really hadn't intended to kill anyone, then they would let you stay there in the city. And the avenger blood could not come in there and get you. You'd be safe. It was a place of refuge. If you left that city, however, the avenger blood could kill you. You had to stay within the city of refuge. The exception being if the high priest died. Whoever was the high priest at the time you committed the murder by accident, if that priest died, then you were free to leave. Now, why this is, I don't exactly know. I've always thought it was probably symbolic. I've always felt the cities of refuge represented salvation in Christ, that when a person comes and flees for refuge to Christ, they find mercy there, but there's a sense in which under the law, which the cities of refuge were a provision of law, under the law, a person would, you know, still be in bondage. The law may have been actually the refuge. Maybe that's the way we should see it. But when the high priest Jesus died, then of course the people who were trapped or in bondage in the city of refuge were set free to go at liberty. But I don't know exactly if that was intended. That's a thought that I've always had about this, but I don't know if that's, you know, the Holy Spirit's mind on it. Anyway, this brief chapter, chapter 20, only 9 verses long, is given to name for us which of the cities were chosen to be the cities of refuge. Now, chapter 21, then, we have to deal with the last of the tribes to be considered. All the others have been given inheritance except for the tribe of Levi. Now, the tribe of Levi, we've already been told a number of times, is not going to receive a portion. But they still have to live somewhere. And they still own some things. I mean, they own cattle. They needed some grazing land. They needed houses to live in. And so there were certain cities, and the cities were selected from the territories of all the other tribes. And they were Levitical cities given to the Levites to live in. And they were cities with their suburbs and with their surrounding grazing lands, which would belong to the Levites, or the Levites, the Levites, the children of Levi. And so that is what we deal with here. And it names the cities of the Levites. Now, we don't need to read all these cities, but what we can see is that it breaks it down into the three groups of Levites. There were three sons of Levi, Kohath, Gershon, and Merari. And we've been acquainted with these three divisions among the Levites from the way back in the book of Exodus, where they all had their own chores to do with respect to the transportation of the tabernacle. Well, each of these groups is given individually. In verses 4 through, I guess the names aren't actually all given here. They are given later in the chapter. That's right. Verse 4 simply tells us that 13 cities were given to the Kohathites, but then verse 5 tells us there were some other Kohathites besides and they received 10 more cities. Now, who these different groups of Kohathites were, we don't know. All we know is that it says the Kohathites were given 13 cities, and then some more Kohathites were given 10 cities. And then the Gershonites were given 13 cities. They're mentioned, that is said so in verse 6. And in verse 7 it says the children of Merari, they received 12 cities. Now the names of these cities are given immediately following. In verses 10 through 19, it names the 13 cities that were given to the Kohathites. And then in verses 20 through 26, it names the 10 cities that were given to the other Kohathites. So there are 23 cities altogether given to the Kohathites. And then in verses 27 through 33, it names for us the 13 cities given to the children of Gershon. And in verses 34 through 40, it tells us the 12 cities of the children of Merari. Altogether, there were 48 cities given to the Israelites, to the Levites, from among the tribes of Israel. Okay, and those cities are named for us. Then in verses 41 to the end of the chapter, it says, all the cities of the Levites within the possession of the children of Israel were 48 cities with their suburbs. These cities were every one with their suburbs round about them. Thus were all these cities. And the Lord gave unto Israel all the land which he sware to give unto their fathers. And they possessed it and dwelt therein. And the Lord gave them rest round about according to all that he sware unto their fathers. And there stood not a man of all their enemies before them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand. There failed not aught of any good thing which the Lord had spoken unto the house of Israel. All came to pass. So we're told that the promise that were made to Abraham as far as what land his seed would inherit was totally conquered. It became theirs. Now, God had told Abraham that the territory would include all the land all the way over to the river Euphrates, which Tim informed me the other day is 500 miles to the east of the River Jordan. And there's no reference to that territory in this description of the conquests. And so I'm not sure exactly how the writer intended for us to understand this. We do know that David and Solomon later controlled all the heathen all the way as far as the Euphrates, because it tells us that in 1 Kings that Saul's domain included all the nations as far east as the Euphrates. That would simply mean that those nations paid tribute to Solomon. It doesn't mean the Jews inhabited those lands. But that would be a fulfillment of the promise made to Abraham. But anyway, the writer is telling us there was left nothing unsubdued. There really, I suppose, were not very many peoples in that great desert between these conquered territories and the Euphrates. It's possible that it was just considered there's not much left out there to consider conquering. You know, if the Jews wanted to, they could control it. There wasn't anything there, a big old desert. At any rate, the author is convinced that the promises to Abraham concerning the land have been fulfilled at this point. And I might say this about the Levitical cities. The Levites, I think, are in a special sense a type of the church, even though the whole nation Israel, in another sense, is a type of the church. There are certainly types within types in the Bible. Because we are a king's priests, and the Levites were a tribe of priests. Of course, not all the Levites were priests. Only the family of Aaron were actual priests, but the other Levites who were not actual priests still were laborers at the tabernacle. They still were about the holy orders. And so their function was to be separated unto God. He was their inheritance. The church is like that among the nations of the world. As the Levites were among the tribes of Israel, so are we among the peoples of the world. The Levites were and the priests were to teach people the law, to offer sacrifice on their behalf, to remain holy unto the Lord, whereas the other tribes could go about other business if they wished. The Levites were separated unto God's business alone. And so the church among the nations of the world has the duty of teaching the nations the law of God or the gospel, as Jesus has told us to go out into all the world and teach all nations. We are to offer sacrifices on behalf of the rest of the nations of the world, that is prayers, which is the sacrifices that we offer. And we're supposed to remain holy unto the Lord. And just like the Levites, we don't receive here any portion in this earth. This world is not our home. The Levites did not receive a portion in the land because they were like us. They had the Lord as their portion. We are regarded as having our citizenship in heaven. Therefore, even though we have cities to live in, or we have places, we have communities, there are Christian communities in the earth. There are churches where we gather and where we conduct our lives. Yet we are not regarding ourselves as part of this world. We are, as it says in 1 Peter chapter 2, strangers and pilgrims here. God has not given us here any continuing city, it says in Hebrews chapter 13. We have here no continuing city. We seek one to come. So, like the Levites, we don't have an inheritance of real estate. The church does not. There's not some nation that is God's nation. There's not some territory on the planet that belongs to the church. I mean, sure, we own properties where the church buildings are and things like that, but as far as owning some national real estate, as Israel did, for instance, we don't have that. There is no nation today that is God's special nation. The people of God do not have a portion in this world. But we will inherit the earth someday, Jesus said. Now, chapter 22 is actually a fairly long chapter. It's not long because there's a lot in it. It just takes a long time to say the little bit is in it. Essentially, the chapter is about how Joshua now released the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh to go back over Jordan and to inhabit their lands, which, of course, they had to do because they had now helped their brethren to conquer all their territory. They'd left their women and children and cattle on the other side, where they'd been separated from them for years. And now they could go back and rejoin their families and their possessions and settle. It depends on the east side of Jordan. That's what happens here. Joshua releases them to go back. The job of the war is over. But no sooner have they gone back than they build a huge imposing altar on the eastern shore of the Jordan, where everyone can see it. Now, this concerns the brothers on the other side of Jordan because they apparently misrepresent the intentions of the Reubenites, Gadites, and Manassites, as though they are saying, we're not going to worship at Shiloh, at the tabernacle, we're going to make our own altar over here. Now, this would, of course, suggest that they were apostatizing from God, that they were, or from the religion of the rest of the nation. And so all their other brethren, the 9.5 tribes on the west side of Jordan, gathered to war, to make war with the 2.5 tribes on the other side. And it turned out to be a big misunderstanding. It was communicated that they never intended to really forsake the altar at Shiloh, and that this altar that they built was just a memorial, that they belonged to the Lord. And so everything turned out happy in the end. You can actually read the chapter, but I've just summarized its entire contents. They named the altar Ed in verse 34. And the children of Reuben and the children of Gad called the altar Ed. So you might want to keep that in mind. Okay? Let's look at chapter 22 real quickly here. Then Joshua called the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, and said unto them, ye have kept all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, and have obeyed my voice in all that I commanded you. Ye have not left your brethren these many days and today, but have kept the charge of the commandment of the Lord your God. And now the Lord your God hath given you rest unto your, hath given rest unto your brethren as he promised them. Therefore now return ye, and get you unto your tents, and unto the land of your possession, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side Jordan. But take diligent heed to do the commandment and the law, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, charged you, to love the Lord your God, and to walk in all his ways, and to keep his commandments, and to cleave unto him, and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. So Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and went unto their tents. Now, to the one half of the tribe of Manasseh, Moses had given possession of Bashan, but unto the other half thereof gave Joshua among the brethren on this side of Jordan westward. And when Joshua sent them away also unto their tents, then he blessed them, and he spake unto them, saying, return with much riches unto your tents, and with very much cattle, with silver, and with gold, and with brass, and with iron, and with very much raiment. Divide the spoil of your enemies with your brethren. So they were taking back with them the spoils of battle as they returned to their families. and they were going to live wealthy. And the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh returned and departed from the children of Israel out of Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan, to go unto the country of Gilead, to the land of their possession, whereof they were possessed, according to the word of the Lord by the hand of Moses. And when they came unto the borders of Jordan, that are in the land of Canaan, the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh built there an altar by Jordan, a great altar, to see to. Now, this is what caused the misunderstanding. Verse 11, and the children of Israel heard say, behold, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half-tribe of Manasseh have built an altar over against the land of Canaan in the borders of Jordan at the passage of the children of Israel. And when the children of Israel heard it, the whole congregation of the children of Israel gathered themselves together at Shiloh to go up to war against them. These people were trigger happy, you know. But then they just spent 6 years wiping everybody out. You know, you kind of get bloodthirsty, right? After a lifestyle of killing, you just kind of decide, well, who can we kill next? Oh, good, these people have offended us, so go kill them. But actually, they didn't really delight to go to war against them. They felt they were doing this in loyalty to God. As God had told them to wipe out all the idolaters among the Canaanites, they probably felt like God wanted them to do the same to keep the purity of their own nation from tribes that were seemingly defecting. And the children of Israel sent unto the children of Reuben, and to the children of Gad, and to the half-tribe of Manasseh, unto the land of Gilead, Phinehas, son of Eleazar the priest. Eleazar, you remember, was Aaron's son. Phinehas was therefore his Aaron's grandson. And with him 10 princes, of each chief house a prince throughout all the tribes of Israel, and each one was a head of a house and of their fathers among the thousands of Israel. So they sent the chief leaders of the 10 tribes across the Jordan to talk to the leaders of the offending 2.5 tribes. And they came unto the children of Reuben, and unto the children of Gad, and to the half-tribe of Manasseh, unto the land of Gilead. And they spake with them, saying, thus saith the whole congregation of the Lord, what trespass is this that ye have committed against the God of Israel, to turn away this day from following Jehovah, and have builded you an altar, and that ye might rebel this day against the Lord? Is the iniquity of Peor too little for us? That was when the Moabites led the children of Israel into idolatry and fornication at the council of Balaam, which they remembered from the book of Numbers. From which we are not cleansed until this day, although there was a plague in the congregation of the Lord, but that ye must turn away this day from following the Lord. And it will be, seeing ye rebelled today against the Lord, that tomorrow he will be wroth with the whole congregation of Israel. Notwithstanding, if the land of your possession be unclean, then pass ye over unto the land of the possession of the Lord, wherein the Lord's tabernacle dwelleth, and take possession among us. But rebel not against the Lord, nor rebel against us, in building you an altar beside the altar of the Lord our God. Did not Achan the son of Zerah commit a trespass in the accursed thing, and wrath fell on all congregation of Israel? And that man perished not alone for in his iniquity? Because, of course, 36 died in battle because of his iniquity, plus his own family. So his one sin affected many people, is what's being said here. Then the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh answered and said unto the heads of the thousands of Israel, the Lord God of gods, the Lord God of gods, he knoweth, and Israel he shall know, if it be in rebellion, or if in transgression against the Lord, save us not this day, that we have built us an altar to turn from the following of the Lord, or if to offer thereon burnt offering or meat offering, or if to offer peace offerings thereon, let the Lord himself require it. In other words, we didn't mean this to offer sacrifices on. This is just a memorial we've set up. And if we have not rather done it for fear of this thing, saying, in time to come your children might speak unto our children, saying, what have ye to do with the Lord God of Israel? Those on the east side of Jordan, outside of the land, were afraid that their descendants might be looked down upon by the descendants of those who lived within the land. And so somehow they reasoned that building this altar would show their loyalty to the same God of Israel. And that was their rationale for building. Verse 25, for the Lord hath made Jordan a border between us and you. Ye children of Reuben, ye children of Gad, ye have no part in the Lord. This is what they were afraid their descendants would say. So shall your children make our children from fearing the Lord. Therefore, we said, let us now prepare to build us an altar, not for burnt offering nor for sacrifice, but that it might be a witness between us and you, our generations after us, that we might do the service of the Lord before Him with our burnt offerings, and with our sacrifices, and with our peace offerings, that your children may not say to our children in time to come, ye have no part in the Lord. Therefore, said we, that it shall be when they should so say to us, or to our generations in time to come, that we may say, behold, the pattern of the altar of the Lord which our fathers made, not for burnt offerings, nor for sacrifice, but it is a witness between us and you. God forbid that we should rebel against Jehovah, and turn this day from the following Jehovah, to build an altar for burnt offering, for meat offerings, or for sacrifices beside the altar of the Lord, our God that is before His tabernacle. And when Phinehas the priest and the princes of the congregation and the thousands of Israel which were with him heard the words that the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the children of Manasseh spoke, it pleased them. Phinehas the son of Eleazar the priest said unto the children of Reuben and to the children of Gad and the children of Manasseh, this day we perceive that the Lord is among us, because ye have not committed this trespass against the Lord. Now ye have delivered the children of Israel out of the hand of the Lord. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, and the princes, returned from the children of Reuben and from the children of Gad, out of the land of Gilead, unto the land of Canaan, to the children of Israel, and brought them word again. And the thing pleased the children of Israel, and the children of Israel blessed God, and did not intend to go up against them in battle, to destroy the land wherein the children of Reuben and Gad dwelt. And the children of Reuben and the children of Gad called the altar Ed, for it shall be a witness between us that the Lord is God. Ed means a witness. And so they said, it shall be a witness. So this altar was not an altar for burning sacrifices, but just to stand as a memorial of their dedication to the God of Israel. Shows how misunderstandings can almost lead to divisions in the body of Christ. It's a good thing that the children of Israel on the west side of Jordan sent a delegation to communicate before going to war, so they could clear this thing up. A lot of times, Christians in one church or in one part of a church hear rumors about what someone else has done, and they jump to conclusions, and then there's a full-blown war or feud or division in the body of Christ simply because there's been a failure to go to the person who's offended and say, you know, this, what's going on here, and to get an explanation. A lot of times, divisions and fightings could be averted by that kind of precaution. Well, let's take